Great. You may have come across this phrase before. Don't find yourself on the wrong side of history. It's become a kind of popular thing in our lingo, basically since Barack Obama. It was one of his favorite phrases in his presidency, and now we all seem to use it. And of course, the reason this is so well used, the idea of being on the right side of history, is because it does have real logic to it, real traction. And the point is that if you know where history is heading, and especially if it's the true and right endpoint, then of course the smart move is going to be to get in step with it, even if that might have drawbacks in the short term. If you were with us last week, I used this picture. It's a famous picture during, and it represents really resistance, doesn't it? When everyone else is going one way and you're resisting and going the other way. And during World War II, when France was occupied by the Nazis, both nationally and in each town, the Nazis set up a kind of puppet leadership. And the smart money, a lot of people thought, was just to go with the flow, just cozy up with the new leadership and accept the new status quo. Why not? Except there were some, weren't there? A minority, especially as they heard the news that the Allied forces were poised to liberate France, who decided instead to throw their lot in with the resistance movement, even if that meant being out of step with and risking persecution and death from the prevailing powers. And whilst it was very costly in the short term to be part of that movement, the resistance movement was driven by this desire to be on the right side of history and to be vindicated in the end. Now, I think this is a great illustration of what happened when the gospel came, because when these Christians in Asia Minor, modern day Turkey, when they first these are the first hearers of this letter, Revelation, when they first heard about Jesus, the true ruler of this world, the one who died for their sins and is going to come back one day to put everything right, they switched their primary loyalty to King Jesus, even though, as we're discovering in Revelation, that put them out of step with the culture they were in. For some, it meant martyrdom even. And the whole point of this letter that's being written to them is to say, don't find yourself on the wrong side of history. And part of the way John the writer does this is outlining, we've seen this, haven't we, what happens or what is going to happen to Jesus' enemies. If you've been with us the previous few weeks, we've seen the defeat of the prostitute in chapter 17. Then we saw the defeat of the beast and the false prophet last week in chapter 19. And today's section deals with the final defeat of Satan himself. And in verse 10 of our reading, he was thrown into the lake of fire and sulfur. And what is different in today's chapter is the extra information we're given about the two-stage defeat of Satan and the impact that has on how we consider this age that we're living in now, which I take to be between the two judgments of Satan in our passage. And the point here is that it's one thing to know how the story is going to end. That's very important so that we can make sure we're on the right side of it. But also, it's very helpful to know something about the waiting time that we're in as well. So, yes, the Allies are going to liberate Europe, or yes, Jesus is going to come and defeat his enemies. But is the waiting time going to be short or is it going to be long? And that makes a difference. And what are the priorities to be in the meantime as we wait? And that's part of what this passage we're looking at today is going to help us with. So before we get into the detail of it, it's worth saying this chapter is perhaps the most disputed part of the book. Five times it describes a millennium, 1,000 years. And where the millennium fits into the general scheme of history is something that is hotly debated by Christians, has been historically, still is today. And given the time that we've got, I'm going to spend most of our time just trying to outline the view that I'm persuaded of. That is that the 1,000 years is a symbolic way of describing this age that we're currently living in, rather than going through all the different options. But I'm aware that I know there will be different views out there, and I'm very happy to chat more about the different options afterwards if that's going to be a help. So we've got these two main points today about how to be on the right side of history, how to live wisely in the meantime. And the two points, number one and two, the millennium of opportunity is now. And point two, the day of separation is coming. And then under point one, we're going to spend a bit longer on point one because it's got three sub-points. Satan's lies are restrained, God's people are ruling, and it will end with Satan's defeat. So let's get into it. Let's look at point one, the millennium of opportunity, and the first sub-point, Satan's lies are restrained. And I'm going to pick up from verse one. Let me read. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, holding in his hand the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain. And he seized the dragon, that ancient serpent, who's called the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years, and threw him into the pit and shut it and sealed it over him. Just notice in passing here, this won't be new to you if you're used to Revelation, but just notice how weak Satan is here compared to God. Back in chapter 13, when Satan controlled the social and political forces and was persecuting the saints, he gave the illusion that evil was invincible. And yet here we see behind the scenes what the reality is, that he's completely under God's control. Actually, what makes it much more degrading for Satan here, did you notice it's one of God's subordinates who puts him in chains here? And notice as well what particular freedom is being taken from him. Let me read again, verse 3. And the angel threw him into the pit and shut it and sealed it over him so that he might not deceive the nations any longer until the 1,000 years were ended. So we're introduced here to what is in the terms of the book, the next stage of Satan's downfall. You might remember back in chapter 12 that one form of Satan's activity has already been halted. Do you remember when Jesus was exalted up into heaven, Satan was cast down, and we learnt that wonderful news that Satan's accusations against Jesus' people will no longer be heard in heaven. It isn't just that he lost that case, he's been barred from any further appearances in court. There's no right of appeal, it's just a smackdown. It's great news, and we thought about that in chapter 12. And yet here in chapter 20, we now discover that another area of Satan's activity has been restrained, and that is his power to deceive the nations. I guess we all want to know, you know, when did this happen? Or when will it happen? When does the binding take place? And there's only one other reference in Scripture to Satan being bound, and it comes up in the Gospels. It comes up in Matthew 12, which Pippa read for us, and in Mark 3. And in that first reading, it describes how Jesus' authority over Satan, his driving out of evil spirits during his earthly ministry, is because in his announcement of the kingdom, he has bound Satan. So the verse said this, Jesus said, "If it is by the Spirit of God that I cast out demons, then the kingdom of God has come upon you. Or how can someone enter a strong man's house and plunder his goods unless he first binds the strong man?" There's the key word. "Then indeed he may plunder his house." And it's a big clue there that Jesus' binding of Satan happened as a result of Jesus's earthly ministry. And in John chapter 12, this was our theme verse that we began with, actually, Jesus makes an explicit connection between Satan's defeat and the nations being freed from their deceptions and being enabled to come at last to Jesus. So John 12, "Now is the judgment of this world. Now will the ruler of the world, Satan, be cast out. And I, when I'm lifted up from the earth, lifted up on the cross, will draw all people to myself." So do you see, Jesus is saying that at the cross in particular, Satan is being beaten and the nations at last are being released so they can be gathered, they're released from deception. And the point here is that here and now, in this present age, we discover that Satan's deceptions are restrained. And if you have any doubt of that, look around this Zoom room. You know, we've got people from all different nations understanding the truth, worshipping Jesus. And this is the great evidence that Satan has been held back, the church gathering week by week. Now is the day of salvation. Now is the window of grace. Now is the millennium, as it's called in this passage, of opportunity. And actually, every time another person receives the truth about Jesus, we see that Satan's inability to deceive the nations is proclaimed afresh. And the point is, this is a wonderful age to be living in, isn't it? When we can receive the truth and know what's really going on. And I take it that it's called a millennium because it's in contrast to other time markers in Revelation. If you've been with us, there've been, you know, 3.5 years or 42 months and different time markers. But this one is 1,000 years. And the point is that this is going to be a substantial chunk of time. Back in chapter 7, you'll remember John saw this wonderful vision of a great multitude that no one could number from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes, palm branches in their hands, crying out with a loud voice, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." And here we see what's going to happen. The Lord is going to delay his final judgment for a millennium, we discover in chapter 20. And we get a hint of why he's doing it. He's doing it in mercy. He's doing it in order to give time for the nations, that's us, to turn and receive the truth. What a God we have. And we're very aware of God's kindness in this, aren't we? I guess, especially as we look around us, even in this Zoom room, and we see people who, if Jesus had returned, say, a decade ago or even a year ago, some of us would have been caught out by that. And the point is that every day of this millennium is a day of mercy. It's a day to thank God for it. And there's more. It's not just that in this age, Satan's lies are restrained, but also happening in this age is that God's people are ruling. If you've been with us again through this whole series of Revelation, you'll remember one of the key moments in this book was that point in chapter 6 when John saw under the altar in heaven the martyrs crying out with a loud voice, "Oh, sovereign Lord, holy and true, how long before you will judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth?" And at that time, the martyrs were told to wait, rest a little longer until the full number of martyrs was complete. And this question that the martyrs ask of God has been hanging over this whole book, hasn't it? Until, as we approach the end of the book, when one by one the persecutors have started to be judged by God. And then here in chapter 20, we discover that in addition to the persecutors being thrown down, the martyrs themselves are now lifted up to rule from heaven. So let's read together. Verse 4, John says, "Then I saw thrones, and seated on them were those to whom the authority to judge was committed. Also, I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for the testimony of Jesus and for the word of God, and those who had not worshipped the beast or its image and had not received its mark on their foreheads or their hands. They came to life and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. Same 1,000 years again. And this idea of human beings, God's people being raised up to rule with Jesus, it's actually not new to us in the book of Revelation. It's been trailed already, especially if you were with us in the Bible studies in the letters to the seven churches. So we heard in chapter 2, when the church in Thyatira were told, chapter 2, 26, "The one who conquers and keeps my word until the end." So he's talking there about Christians who remain faithful to Jesus right to the end of their life. "To him I will give authority over the nations, and he will rule them with a rod of iron." You get the same idea again with the church in Laodicea. They were told, "The one who conquers, I will grant him to sit with me on my throne, as I also conquered and sat down with my Father on his throne. And here in chapter 20, it's hinted that this ruling, which has been promised, it begins not in the new creation after Jesus returns. It actually begins now in this age. We're told here that it's during the millennium. I don't want to be dogmatic here because I know it's a difficult passage and there isn't a whole lot of other data on this elsewhere in the New Testament to help us. But it seems that just as earlier in the book, that those dead martyrs in chapter 6 prayed for vindication from under the altar. Come on, Lord, please act in history, avenge our blood and so on. Now we're shown that they can call for God to fulfill his purposes, not from under the throne, not from under the altar, but now on thrones. In some way, they're ruling with Christ over this world, over history. And incidentally, I don't think it's only martyrs who are currently reigning with Christ in heaven. As the Lord said to the churches in Thyatira and Laodicea, it's anyone who conquers who gets this promise. But martyrs are particularly in focus here for a reason. Because the key point, I think, is how the Lord loves to vindicate, especially those who suffer for their faith. Imagine if you were in one of these churches, you were in the church at Pergamum, and there's this guy Antipas, who was your small group leader, and he just got martyred for his faith. And if you were in that situation, you know, and every time another Antipas from your church was killed, it would feel like another victory for the enemy, wouldn't it? To any onlooker, at least, it looks like the persecutors are winning. And yet what these verses do is they pull back the veil and they show us what's really going on. And they remind us Antipas is not a loser. In fact, his persecutors, rather than defeating him as they put him to death, they have succeeded in promoting him several rungs above the emperor. Antipas is now sitting on a heavenly throne, reigning with Christ over this world. And the point is being made, God can be counted on. He will always vindicate those who suffer for him. That's a great encouragement to believers of every age. And the point for us, of course, is that we don't need to worry. We don't need to fear hard times. When it's hard for us being in the resistance movement, when it feels like we're losing all the time. I guess people will be aware of people we know who have lost popularity or lost reputations or lost careers, lost security. It feels like we're losing. And yet these verses assure us, don't they, that ultimately we cannot lose. I gave the example earlier in the series of what I call the capsize principle, and I think it's very relevant for these verses as well. And the capsize principle, I'll try and explain. I used to race dinghies when I was growing up. There I am trying to pass on this activity to Lottie, and this is quite a few years ago. And one of the things when I was growing up that my dad told us before a race was to do the quick capsize drill. You know, if you're familiar with dinghy sailing, you flip the boat over, you flip it back, and because you've capsized and you've got wet, you've remembered that the worst that can happen isn't really that bad at all. And then it gives you confidence when it comes to the race to sail much better and much nearer to the limit. And these verses invite us to do that thought experiment. You know, what is the worst that can happen if I'm public about my faith? And you think of the worst scenario, you know, even if I'm killed, as we see here, we only end up being promoted to greater influence, greater joy, reigning with Christ in heaven. And once we've done that capsized thought experiment, it makes a huge difference to our confidence. We're bulletproof, aren't we? We can be brave at school, we can be brave at work, in all kinds of less scary outcomes than martyrdom, and we can start to be more bold and confident in our faith. So we've been thinking about what we can expect in this age as we wait. We've seen, one, Satan's lies are restrained. Number two, God's people are ruling today. And thirdly, verses 7 to 10, this is, this age will end with Satan's defeat. And these verses that we're going to look at now explain what will happen right at the close of this age, just before the Lord Jesus returns. And incidentally, this is a very similar scenario, I think, to the one Paul outlines in 2 Thessalonians 2, which is one of the things, for me at least, which commends this way of reading Revelation. You can read that afterwards if that's of interest. But let's pick it up from chapter Revelation 20, verse 7. And when the 1,000 years are ended, so right at the close of this age, Satan will be released from his prison and will come out to deceive the nations that are at the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them for battle. Their number is like the sand of the sea. And they march up over the broad plain of the earth and surround the camp of the saints and the beloved city. But fire came down from heaven and consumed them. And the devil who had deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and sulfur, where the beast and the false prophet were, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. So we're being told here that just before the end, things will get worse before they get a lot, lot better for God's people. So Satan is going to have one last attempt to wipe out the church before God intervenes and stops him in his tracks. I've been thinking about this week, and I think there are at least three conclusions which I draw from this, from these verses. And the first one is it gives us a little glimpse of what life would be like in this age if God was not restraining Satan right now. And the implication of these verses is that without God's gracious limitation on Satan's activities, you know, if he's just let off the leash, what happens? Well, the church could be wiped out very rapidly indeed. Satan is not a gentleman. He does not abide by the Geneva Convention. And we should be grateful for the protection God is providing for his church even today. So that's one. Second conclusion I take from this teaching is that according to the perspective of Revelation, whenever we see the fiercest persecution in this world, Revelation is preparing us to conclude that it's a mark not of Satan's strength, but of his weakness, of his desperation. We saw this principle actually back in chapter 12, when Satan was cast out of heaven and it said, you know, woe to you, O earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you in great wrath because he knows his time is short. And it's the same principle here in chapter 20. Satan is like an injured animal. He knows he's been beaten and he's on borrowed time. And that is what accounts for his ferocity. And so terrible as it is when people face persecution, it is never a reason to conclude that the enemy is winning. In fact, Revelation tells us the opposite. It means that he's very, very desperate and we shouldn't be discouraged. And the third conclusion I take from this section is that God is a magnificent storyteller. Think about it. The climax to this age we're discovering is wonderfully planned for maximum dramatic impact. We should know this already if we know the gospel. The gospel is, isn't it, the perfect amalgam of every good storyline in literature. It's the story of the great quest as the hero leaves heaven on this treacherous journey through danger and hardship. The gospel is the story of overcoming the monster as the dragon is thrown down. It's the story of love lost and then found as the heroine goes astray and then is rescued. It's the story of tragedy turned into comedy as Christ emerges from the grave and finally becomes one with his bride at this glorious wedding banquet. The point is, God is the best storyteller and he uses history to tell his story. And just think, you know, not just the events of the gospel, but right through the Bible. When does God ever save the day at the sixth hour when he could do it at the 11th? It's just not his style. Or when does God win a battle with even odds when he could do it with impossibly improbable odds? And this climax to this present age is perfectly written here for maximum glory and joy. just at that moment when mankind's enemy is about to wreak destruction on God's people, what happens? That is the moment the Lord chooses to intervene, and he gives the devil his final comeuppance. What a God we worship. Now, so far, the verses have been helping us set our expectations about this age. It's the millennium of opportunity, as I've called it. But the passage ends with a different time frame. It's the day of separation which is coming, the day of judgment. And that is the day when the opportunity for turning to Christ will be over. So let's look at this finally together now. Verse 11, then I saw a great white throne and him who was seated on it. From his presence, earth and sky fled away, and no place was found for them. And I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne, and books were opened. Now, this is talking about an event which is coming, which none of us is going to put in our diaries, and yet every one of us will attend. In fact, everyone who's ever lived will attend this event. Earlier in the book, when the preliminary warning judgments came in chapter 6, people tried to hide themselves in caves and in rocks of the ground. But this judgment is different. There's going to be no hiding at all on that day. Those of us who sing "In the Bleak Midwinter" each Christmas will know this line: "Our God, heaven cannot hold him, nor earth sustain. Heaven and earth shall flee away when he comes to reign." It's taken from this verse here in Revelation. There'll be no hiding on that day. Heaven and earth will flee from God's presence. And verse 12 says that books will be opened. Some people believe, don't they, that our lives are ultimately meaningless, that there's no ultimate right or wrong, no final accounting, and that in the final scheme of things, everything that human beings have thought and said and done will be lost forever in the, you know, final death of the universe. And yet the Bible teaches what I think we instinctively know, that actually there is meaning. There is an accounting, that one day books will be opened detailing everything we have thought, said and done. And therefore it turns out that everything is meaningful. Everything matters in our lives. And the verses go on. Then another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged by what was written in the books, according to what they had done. You get a repeated phrase, according to what they had done. Judgment is never arbitrary with God. Everyone is judged according to what they have done. No one who is condemned will be able to protest that it's not just. Just is exactly what it is, scrupulously just. Some people protest that they've always done their best. And yet, of course, we know that none of us actually live up even to our own standards, let alone God's. None of us have actually done our best consistently. Sometimes our children yell, it's a kind of catchphrase for children, "That's not fair." And whilst it's good to try and be fair, especially for parents, sometimes I ask the question of the children whether raw fairness is actually what they want in life. I, for one, am hoping for something a lot better than raw justice on that day. I'm holding out for grace, for mercy. And wonderfully, that is what it means to have our names in the book of life, there in verse 12. Back in chapter 3, Jesus told the church in Sardis, "To the one who conquers, they will be clothed in white garments, and I will never blot his name out of the book of life." Same phrase. And then he explains, "I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels." So the point is that to have our name in that book means that we belong to Jesus. It means that he is going to be our advocate on the final day. He's the one who's going to plead for us. He's going to confess our name before the Father. And Jesus has a brilliant argument. This one is with me. This one's sins have already been paid for and they're safe. And that argument is foolproof. And on that day, that is the only argument which can carry any weight with the judge of all. And we see this down in verse 15. Let me read from the second paragraph there. If anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. And we've discovered that is the destiny of Satan himself. It's this picture of utter and ongoing destruction. Now we're going to think more about the eternal future that awaits Jesus's people over the next 3 weeks. It's going to be lovely to focus on that after these sobering verses. But just notice in passing, really, in verse 14 here, then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. What is being described here is something glorious. It is the death of death. Do you see that? God doesn't simply bring the dead to life. We discover here he terminates death's power to assault his people again. And we're going to see more of this next week, you know, when we're told death shall be no more. It's very hard for us to get our heads around this new normal that we're going to get used to. It's not that we're going to forget death ever existed, you know, not least actually because our Saviour's body still contains the scars of his passion, you know, the nail marks. We're going to forever praise the Lamb for the blood that he's shed. So we won't forget death was a thing. But I'm guessing there will come a day in 20,000 years' time when one of us here will say to someone else in this room, hey, do you remember death? And the other person will reply, yeah, that was a killer, wasn't it? Or, you know, something probably more witty than that, given all the time we've had to develop our, you know, comic skills. And the point is that there really is a judgment coming. And the two outcomes here could not be more different. They're just absolutely in different worlds. And we began, didn't we, by thinking about this issue. Don't find yourself on the wrong side of history. What that means for us is that we're to live in the light of this day of separation, this day of judgment, which is coming. And this passage also gives us a lot of help as we await, as we look forward to this day. And it's going to be a difficult waiting time. Our life here may be like the life of that French resistance movement. It looks like it will be. We're going to be out of step with the prevailing powers for a long time. But as we've seen in this passage, whether we're loyal to the current regime or whether we're loyal to the liberating force, Jesus, is actually going to make a huge difference in the end, on the day of liberation. There's going to be a permanent separation between these groups. And so alongside making sure we're in the right group ourselves, which is very important, the encouragement of this passage is surely to make the most of this window of opportunity, this millennium, to help others join the resistance movement while there's still time. There are people I know who every time I see them, I can't help but think of the Lord's kindness and how he brought them to himself. You know, if I see my friend Nick, I can't help but think that when I first knew him, when we were first friends, he was very antagonistic about Christians. And then we prayed for him and through the Christian Union mission, he heard the gospel and now he's going really strong in the Lord. And just seeing him reminds me of that. And it's a great encouragement. Or I think of so-and-so whom I, you know, first met when they were brought along to the Skeptics Guide Curry event, say. And now I see them, you know, going really well in the Lord and it lifts my heart. And so let's be praying that this year, this term even, the Lord does wonderful miracles amongst us again. Wouldn't it be great if he brought people to know the truth, to be ready for that day of separation, which is coming. So what a time to be praying to that end. I'm going to leave a bit of time now for us to reflect on these verses, what it means for us to be in step with where history's heading, and then we'll have our prayers in a moment.